Welcome to AB Testing Podcast, your modern testing podcast. Your hosts, Alan
Hi.
And Brent,
not Brent,
will be here to guide you through topics on testing, leadership, agile, and anything else that comes to mind. Now, on with the show.
Hey everyone, back for AB Testing. It's just me, S for spy, don't call me Alan. And Brent is still on hiatus. He is, I believe he's massaging Satya Nadella's feet right now. And so instead, I have my good friend, Tim, here. Tim, say hi.
Hello, everybody.
All right. So Tim's going to fill in and play the role of Brent, which means I'm going to yell at him, make fun of him. Are you ready for it, Tim?
Yeah, and I may use your dead name because I'm not used to calling you Spy yet.
So. Okay, well, get used to it. I don't even, it's so
I
weird.
Apologize up front.
It's all right. People will learn. People will learn. It doesn't help that my little name tag at the bottom here has my government name on it. So, if you're just tuning into the podcast, this is our second one after I took a 4.5 month hiatus to go walk from Mexico to Canada. Had a blast. And along the way, my name changed. It's no longer the old name that you may know me by. It's now Spy. And that's who I am to anybody that met me on the trail. So for those of you, one of you listening, one of the three did meet on the trail and everybody else just learned to call me my new name. Good meme posted on our Slack group this week. One of the three.slack.com. You can get an invite there from moderntesting.org. It's the one with the astronaut looking at the earth and the other one with a gun behind him. But they said, is Alan Spy? And so it was like, it always has been. So, which is true. It's great. It's wonderful. So Tim, thanks for being here to be my punching bag.
Well, thank you for asking.
Yeah. I'm, as you all know, I'm unemployed and happily unemployed right now, even though I'm kind of looking for, I'm not kind of. I mentioned this last time, not going to the whole big thing. I'm looking for a job. I'm being selective because I don't want to have a job where they don't care about people or software. In fact, I just talked to a former colleague of mine about a lot of this. And anyway, as mentioned last week, my job will probably come through my network versus LinkedIn, but I thought I'd, well, first let me check in with you, see how you're doing. What's up? What's new? How's life?
Oh, life's going good. You know, on that, looking for a job, my spawn is also looking for a job, despite my best ability to talk him out of going into the same tech field that I'm in. He decided that was what he's going to get his degree in. And as anybody who's tried to get a job in the Cascadia Northwest in the tech, it's up and down right now. So
it's a weird world.
He's worked service while he was doing jobs. So while he's doing school, excuse me. And so a opportunity through his network came up to work at a place that's pretty close to where he's living now. So,
oh, that's cool. That's cool. Well, nice. Nice. Meanwhile, here I am playing pickleball with the retirees and going to the gym and goofing off. So yeah. Awesome. So, I want to talk a little bit about, my experiences on the social media platform known as LinkedIn.
Oh boy.
And because I thought I should spend some time there because I'm looking for a job. It turns out that LinkedIn isn't a very good place to look for a job. It's a nice place for recruiters to look for people.
Oh, yeah. For people. I get like three a week. It is usually filled from Florida and Atlanta areas.
Yeah. I
don't live there.
I don't, it's weird. I'll move there for the right job, but I end up scrolling LinkedIn and I haven't been on Twitter for years. I never deleted my account, but I haven't been there, or X as it's called. And I feel like LinkedIn has turned into, when people left that platform, LinkedIn kind of came the place where, I don't know, where they hung out instead.
Oh, I can see that.
There's a lot of random weird posts. So,
I mean, I deleted my Twitter account with a vengeance when
Mr. M bought out the
company. And,
weird. So what happens is I usually once a day, sometimes twice a day, I will make it through two, sometimes three pages of scrolling. And I get disgusted and close LinkedIn until the next day. Just in case a job shows up there. It's a lot.
It's an unhealthy
5 minutes of my day. But what did I see? I'm seeing, like, I've also actively unfollowed people. I know I'm creating an echo chamber, but I don't have time for dumbness.
Who does?
Yeah.
So apparently a lot of people in this country do, but I honestly don't.
So what I found interesting, and we're going to go off in a couple different directions here, is Tim and I both have a fair amount of experience in good project management, agile project management, moving stuff along. I'm a galvanizer. I love to get stuff moving along. Boy, the internet's weird. The post I saw, I'm not going to bring it up. I can't remember the, so I won't quote it. You can't find it, but someone was saying, like, asked the question, and they were trying to be, I think people on LinkedIn, they're just trying to get engagement because they get their ego gets boosted by getting a bunch of impressions and comments. So maybe they're trolling, I think, or they're dumb, yeah, or both. And I can't tell.
Yeah.
They said something like, can you even do agile without a scrum master?
Yes. And, yes, you can. I've been doing it for 2 years.
Well, the point I like to bring up is that Scrum has been around as a framework. And this is, I'm going to get on a soapbox here. Scrum has been around as a framework since before the Agile Manifesto. Agile Manifesto came out, and a bunch of people said, "Oh, but we can't ship software without a framework." Oh, here's one that'll work. And what 90% of the teams do with Scrum, and again, all the roles, you don't need a Scrum Master to do Scrum. You don't need, you don't need most of it. What it did was it gave teams a nice little way to do mini waterfalls back to back to back to back.
Yeah. Yeah.
And there are so many teams lost in the, I need to have a person in this role telling me what to do and making sure we do these rituals. If I recall from looking at Scrum 20 years ago, a lot of these air quote rituals aren't even called rituals in the Scrum original Scrum guide. Doesn't matter. I don't care. The where people get lost in Agile, and I'm going to shut up and give some opinions. Where people get lost in Agile is they focus on iteration, which is not the goal of Agile, instead of adaptability, which is.
Yeah, yeah, and you're catching me raw because I spent the first 3 days of this week in our software programs, program increment.
And we're going to talk about program increments.
Yeah, yeah, we just did our planning.
I will get on a taller soapbox, but I'm going to let you finish.
Yeah, we did our planning for the next 13 weeks. This last 3 days. Yeah, we have longer program increments because we're more synced up with our government customer. So, and they do things on quarters, so we do things on quarters. But yeah, I agree. I've been doing Scrum for 2 years without a Scrum Master. I was originally the Scrum Master when our stuff switched over to Agile, and you know, specifically Safe Agile, which is
Agile. Safe stands for I don't want to do Agile.
Yeah, it really does, because what we did in the first 10, 12 years that I was on this program was waterfall. That was just what we did. And because of the team that I work on, they kind of just sort of left us alone. You know, we would get maybe one, maybe two tasks assigned to us. But, you know, since my team is an operating system development team, that one thing contained a lot of stuff. So they left us alone. Now we switched over to Agile, and it seems like nickel and diming to death, you know, because we have to do every single thing. But they don't understand the concept of story points because they've just assigned an hour value to story points at management level. And it's just a nightmare. Yeah. That's just,
that's the biggest drawback with story points is, and is they, yeah, somebody will do that. And then they're ruined.
Yeah. And it's been that way for about 2 years. And the biggest thing I bang my head against is the, I know this task is going to take you 40 minutes, but you got to put one story point on it because that's as low as we go. Story points are integers. We just got so many other people that try to use a decimalized story points. I'm like, well, that's
stupid.
That's just waterfall. You just tell me how many minutes it's going to be, and we can drop the whole pretense of points.
A story point is a measure of complexity, not a measure of time.
Exactly.
And if the bean counters get involved in a different way, it's difficult. And the challenge, let me talk about two things. One is I've never had Scrum Masters. I believe my development leads are responsible for running their projects however they want to. They can use Scrum. They can use Waterfall. They can use some made up thing. I don't care. Dev leads are in charge of their project management. Now, I'm going to save my safe rant. Am I going to save my safe rant? I'm going to save the safe rant.
All right.
For a minute. The challenge with Agile, remember, adaptable, and story points don't matter. I don't care what they are. You work on things until they're done. And the challenge is you can have there's a whole no estimates, I call it culture, a no estimates movement among the Agile community saying predicting the future is impossible. We're not going to do it. No, we're not going to give you estimates because things are done when they're done and we're working on them in the best way. That's not really fair either because stakeholders, whether it's management or customers or other teams, they kind of want to know when things are going to get done. So it's true. Not the no estimates thing really isn't fair. So I'll give it on that. But the idea is you break down, I always require my teams to give estimates when things are going to get done, but I give them some leeway. I said, there's a great effect. There's one of my favorite books is this Hubbard book called How to Measure Anything. And then he just came out with a new book, an iteration on that called How to Measure Anything in Project Management. But the idea isn't how to measure anything. It's you measure on confidence levels. So I have my teams give P50 estimates or sometimes an estimate like what's your 90% range between this date and this date. They both work and Hubbard uses them both. And then they have permission to be wrong, but they also have permission to learn from that. And what they learn is they have to break stuff down into smaller pieces that can get done. And over time, if you do that over and over, those dates can get more and more accurate. If the bean counters, I'm going to call the pointy hair bosses bean counters, whatever you want to call them. If they get tied to picking a date when something's going to get, or picking how many hours something get done, do the math and say, okay, I'm going to have my widget by next Friday. There's too much uncertainty in software. And as you know, on the technical side, we can break that down. When there's uncertainty, we break it down farther. We try and make it simple by breaking down the problem into smaller problems. And over time, we can get better at picking when those things are going to get done. But there's always are going to be outliers, things that take longer, things that take shorter. And the minute you pick a story point of five and actually get it done in realize it's easy and get done in an hour, they're going to think all the fives should be done in an hour. So as a PO, how do you deal with, tell me more about how you deal with story points and the estimates and people expecting on when stuff's going to get done.
Yeah. Well, so my team's initial problem lies in being and operating as a Kanban team in a sea of Scrum teams. So we've got 8 teams on our program. 2 of them are Kanban. And so everybody else is planning to what sprint is this going to be done in? And we just don't work that way. So when we do planning, we just kind of shuffle all the things into the bin. So we're like, okay, we're not over in any sprint. We have a confidence of 4. We're going to meet plan. And then, the next day we go and shuffle everything around. But when I get my devs to write stories or feature that they aren't quite ready to write the stories for. But stories, I try to contain them to a complexity of 1, 3, or 5. If it's 1, it's super easy, meaning you could probably do 3 or 4 in a day. If it's 3, it's medium hard. It's probably going to take you a couple days. And if it's 5, it's probably going to take you most of a week to get done. If you have a story that's over a 5, which is allowed in all the different frameworks, trainings that I've been shoved down my throat, if it's over a 5, you need to replan that into multiple things because that, if you have a 7 or 12 point story, that doesn't tell you when it's going to get done.
It tells you don't know when you're going to get done.
It tells you when you don't know. Exactly right. And
go ahead and finish.
And we have to meet contractual dates. So we've got to kind of work backwards from those dates and figure out when are we going to get all of the little bits done so that we can meet this date for code cutoff and delivery. But yeah. Once 3s and 5s, it's all I want to see. The occasional 2's fine, but I don't want to see anything over a 5 for my team.
Yeah, and that's good. And again, I always let my teams choose whatever method they want to use to track stuff, but they must give a date with a confidence level. Now, over a year, I delivered like 180 different projects. And a project is something that delivers customer value in some way. And I tracked original estimate, the actual delivery date for every single one of those and a bunch of other data. What I found is, this is going to back up what you said completely. Anything from 1 to 2 weeks was on time, like 80 to 90% of the time, somewhere in there, like pretty accurate. Two weeks or less, pretty accurate. 4 weeks and beyond was all over the map. Ridiculous long. That means there's a length when you cannot figure out how much work there is to do. And interestingly, when people often thought something's going to be easy, they put like, oh, this will be done by Friday. It always took like twice as long. So it's which is fine. They learned from that and they got better. And over time, you want to just give people room to fail so they can target in on these things. Because you want is predictability for your partners, your customers, et cetera. But you have to give them room to screw that up. Now, there was something else I was going to say, and then my brain farted.
That happens.
Yeah, well, age. Crap. What was it? Delivery teams, blah, blah, blah. It'll come back to me. But I don't get why people are. Oh, let me go. It was Kanban. It's about Kanban. So Kanban's great because you're tracking. And again, for an interrupt-driven team, it's the right way to do it versus try and plan those things out. You want to be able to focus on, you know, a finite number of things at once. And as Brent and I always say, focus on finishing, not on doing. Mm-hmm. So you don't have your whole, like, I was working with a team once and they were doing Kanban and they had, I mean, the thing with Kanban is it's a flow chart basically. And you can understand where the bottlenecks are. If things get stuck in one column for too long, you go, okay, what's the problem here? And the problem could be work isn't broken down enough. That's probably where I was going before, is we taught people to break down their work over time. That makes it more predictable, especially if you can deliver, if you have a big feature you're going to deliver for customers, but you can deliver part of it in 2 weeks, give them some value, and then the rest in 2 more weeks, or even spread out longer. That's so, so much better and more predictable. And honestly, you're going to get feedback from customers faster than doing something that takes 6, 8, 10 weeks. Now, with Kanban, working with a team once, they had a big bottleneck in the development thing because they had a bunch of 3, 4, and 5, like longer projects in there. And they kept on upping the limit of, so Kanban has a concept of a work in progress, a WIP. And they had like a limit of 9 in that development. And they had 9 developers. So there's no way for anybody to help each other out. Everybody was stuck on getting their thing done. It's, if you use, and Kanban, I'm just curious in your experience here as well. The beauty of Kanban is you can use it to figure out where the bottlenecks are.
Yes.
and optimize around them. So,
so true.
How does your team do that?
Usually, the way our team is a little, it operates is a little unusual for, what you'd call a Scrum team, doing Kanban in the midst of a bunch of other teams doing Scrum, and that, we try to resort to doing most of the planning between myself, the product owner, and my second in charge, the program manager. And when we have planning, which is what we did the first 3 days of this week, it'll just be me and him doing most of the work. Now, we've had a lot of work run up to it, you know, getting stories and whatnot in ready in place. But for the most part, we try to figure out and work one-on-one with the engineers prior to our planning meetings and figure out what they think they can get done and plan it out accordingly. Then we have to lay out our plan according to the rest of our program groups all being Scrum teams. And we'll lay it all out, and we'll know that things are going to get shuffled around a little bit. And one of the things that we do as because we know our team is going to get stuff changed a lot, we run on a higher pop-up budget than a lot of other teams do. So a lot of the other teams will do like 15-20% of their capacity reserved for pop-up work. And we typically run about 35% because we know that stuff's going to pop up for us. And we typically fill that 35% budget every time. And a lot of times that happens within like 2 weeks after the start of the new Scrum increment, because the customer changed their mind or some new requirement came down. And being on the operating system team, you've got to have, you know, you're basically the lowest part. Things have to get working in your environment before anybody up the line can do their work. Right.
One of the reasons I prefer Kanban over any of the other models is because it allows for that. It's, I mean, if you look at, I mean, so many people who, I mean, there's so many Scrum masters and Scrum folks who are into it and think it's, and equate Scrum with Agile, idiots. They don't even read the documentation on it. What, you know, originally it said that, and I haven't looked at this in years, maybe decades. If you end up adding, you know, I don't know if it was any or an increment. If you're adding work, stop, replan, start over. That burn up is hard. And now, and you can put a buffer in there, which I don't particularly like. It works, but if you're going to be interrupt driven, either don't do Scrum, or do Scrum on a 1 week increment, so that you get that pop up work comes, you can plan it into the thing starting the next Monday.
Yeah.
But don't do a 4 week sprint if you know you're going to have interrupts coming in.
Our team is specifically interrupt driven, mainly because we've kind of gained a reputation as solution fixers. You know, people come to us with the problems that their team's working on, and so that's why our budget for sort of what we call pop-up work is so high, because we know we're going to fill it, we know it's going to come along, and we'll just have to rearrange things.
Yeah, well, it makes sense, and it sounds like, and I'm going to rant on Safe for a second now, then we're going to talk about how to fix it. So for those, it's a scaled agile framework for
enterprise.
Yeah, it is a way for enterprises. So when the pointy hair boss decides he wants to do agile, but he's afraid of it, he can do Safe and not really do agile. So Brent, I'm glad he's not here, because Brent actually is certified in Safe as well.
I have a Scrum Master and a PO certification.
What Safe is, it's a big waterfall framework wrapped around Agile, not necessarily Scrum, although most teams do these product increments, which are Scrum sessions of 2 to 4 weeks. And it's really not Agile at all. If you go back to the manifesto, it's, I'll skip the individual's interactions, but it's working software, customer collaboration, and responding to change. Those are the things they value the most. And when you are delivering things at the end of a 13-week product, how long is your PI?
It's one quarter, so 13 weeks. We typically have we've got usually four sprints of 2 weeks, and then a longer fifth sprint, which is supposed to be your, where you're supposed to be learning new things, but we never have time for that.
People are finishing up all the stuff they didn't get done in the other sprints because they didn't do them right in the first place.
Yeah.
Over promises and those things. It's a big mess. It's not agile. My last company used Safe, and I immediately pulled my team out of Safe completely. It didn't make sense for a platform team. But it was actually done even more horribly. And it was a big bureaucratic meeting fest.
I wish I had that option, but I am, despite being in this job for 20 years and the industry for 30, I'm still just a senior developer. I had zero desire to go into management. So, that really wasn't my option, but.
So here's the challenge, and delivery's hard. So we should not try it, I think is the message. That's not the message. I want to turn this into a leadership conversation.
Good.
I have, do not mention where you work what is it like? Like, how do you communicate the challenges? Like, you know, Safe doesn't work. You're working around it in a bunch of different ways. And I'm sure you're not the only person. I'm sure across your organization, people are going, this is a big mess. There has to be a better way. Why aren't we doing it? What is that like? And why do you think in your case, your management doesn't get it?
Well, I think mainly the management, I won't talk about specifically my managers.
Okay.
The manager I have is talk
in generalities.
That's fine. Because the manager I have now is they were an engineer prior to becoming a manager, and they wanted to be a manager because the manager previous to that was an engineer, but didn't want to be a manager, and they kind of tricked him into it. But, so they understand our current manager understands the ins and outs of the troubles that we have with Agile and SAFe specifically. I think it was the reason that our organization uses it. I think it was dictated by the customer, because they wanted to be able to integrate with something that they're already using, they're already familiar with. So I know that our customer has accounts in our system, so they can check on progress of stories and things like that from their end without having to call somebody up and ask them. And I'm not really sure how you work into a Scrum type or an Agile environment in a company as large as ours and be able to survive. But like I said, my first 10 years there were, we didn't use Agile. We didn't use Scrum. We didn't use any of that stuff. We just kind of, you know, everybody got together on a semi-weekly basis and said, what do we got to do this week? And boom, off we went. And our team usually only had to go like once a month because, you know, we knew all the things that we needed to do. We didn't want to waste a lot of time explaining it to people who didn't really understand.
I want to ask a point of clarification. So you have a customer team that wanted to know when things were going to get done.
Correct.
And the solution was SAFe?
Well, as I mentioned, our customer is the government. So okay. If you have a government contract, you kind of don't have a lot of negotiating space. And I was not involved with any of that. I came onto this program after it was already like 5 years in operation.
Yeah, so. I get it. I guess it would be a little farther up the chain where somebody would, like, my question is, when somebody tells me they need something, I would say, okay, imagine you had that. Tell me what it looks like. And they're, you know, in my view, again, I haven't had government customers. I would think, and I'm sure you think this too, there, and it wasn't your decision to make, but surely there had to be a better solution.
Oh, yes. Yeah. And part of the problem I see over the decades I've been on this is that the leadership or the mid-level leadership of our customer changes out every year, year and a half, 2 years, because people are moving from, you know, people get into government positions and they either stay there for 40 years until they're ready to retire or get, you know, kicked out because they're too old, or they change jobs as often as they can to keep climbing the ladder. And so that's what we see a lot. And it's just, you know, you don't have any consistency from the customer side either.
There is a book. I don't know if you've read this. It's a really good book called Orbiting. I'll show you the picture here, called Orbiting the Giant Hairball.
Oh, good Lord.
It's about, it's a corporate fool's guide to surviving with grace. And one thing it sounds like you've done pretty well, which I've done well and not done well in this for, is when you're in a sickening bureaucracy, is how do you survive? And the author is this guy, is artist who got a job at Hallmark, and how he learned to still be, kind of keep his integrity as a freewheeling artist and also work within what is a surprisingly bureaucratic and political company. Now, I wonder, and obviously people are still employed and they're capable. I want to work on one other story. Just talk to, like right before we talk to an old colleague of mine. And they were challenged because they had 3 different managers in the last year, and none of them really understand what their organization did, and spent a lot of their time just explaining like what they did and the value it brought. And depending on, you know, in most cases, they didn't really care. It was just, you know, so many managers were about people in power versus understanding what's going on. And if you look at the literature on what drives employee engagement, what makes a good organization or what makes a job miserable, is the opposite of that, is people just want to know that they want feedback. They want to know their manager cares about them in their career, and they want to know why their job's important. And I wonder, in a situation where you're following a framework and you're kind of stuck in it, maybe you find ways to work around and orbit the giant hairball. Maybe it's just frustrating, but what's it like? I want to understand a little bit more what it's like when you know there's a better way, but you're doing it the way you're told anyway. Like, what's that like for you and the folks you work with?
Well, it, obviously, we know there's a better way. Well, for us, a better way. And that was, you know, to be basically left unsupervised and off the leash, and we would get the work done. Yeah. Because everybody on our team is an engineer. Some of us got voluntold into these agile positions. And so now I spend upwards of like 70% of my time doing planning and talking to the other engineers and making sure everything goes right. When I got into engineering, because I like doing the engineering part of it. But as for support from above, now in the time that I've been on this team, like 17 plus years, I've had 7 different managers, and some of them were really good managers because they came from engineering, and others didn't. And you could tell which ones were, and the ones that weren't typically didn't last on our as our team's manager for very long. And what I find that my team needs is to be able to just put their heads down, do their work, and at the end of the increment, we're going to come out with what you've asked for. And again, our team is very pop-up driven, but that doesn't cover everybody on the team. There's usually like 2 or 3 people on the team because they're the big brains, you know, big brain on Brad. So they need them to go work this emergent problem on in the labs or an emergent problem on another team. And so they'll jump over to that stuff.
Well, it sounds like you're orbiting the giant hairball pretty well.
We are. We are. So we kind of just work around it. We go, yeah, okay, the giant hairball is there, and we acknowledge it, but we're not going to get hung up by it. We're just going to kind of work around it. And until somebody says, hey, why aren't you trekking through the hairy forest like everyone else is? And we go, well, because you guys want us to meet our release deadline. So we just kind of give you the lip service that, yes, we're doing that, and we just kind of go do our own thing anyway.
Yeah, makes sense.
And we do that by sacrificing 1 or 2 of the senior engineers to doing all the paperwork, as opposed to having to have everybody do all that stuff. Now, like I said, I get some of my engineers to write their own stories, but oftentimes it just falls to me and the program manager to write all the story work because we're the ones that's spending all the time in meetings with other teams and management and the customer. So we kind of know what's going on in the overall. And I just want to let my engineers do engineering and not have to worry so much about this framework, paperwork nightmare.
Yeah,
I mean, and I say paperwork, and I say paperwork, but it's all online, of course.
I know what you mean. It's all policy and bureaucracy. So, no, I get it. It sounds like you're doing a good job navigating the team through that. I tend to get frustrated in those things because when it's not that I even get mad and tell people, I don't go raging, you know, go raging and this is wrong. It's stupid. But I do want to push people. And Brent is, you know, more than one time referred to me as a change agent. I like to make change happen. And I believe in a line from Leadership on the Line, Books on the Floor over there. I won't grab it. Leadership is disappointing people at a level they can absorb. And, you know, when I'm in those situations, I want to push things. I want to change things, I also want to push people a little out of their comfort zone, but not so much they get all freaked out. And it's a little game because everybody gets like, sometimes I can push a little, people freak out, sometimes I push a lot and they don't. You have to kind of read that as you go along. But so many times, it's the right thing to do. I just think a quick reflection on my last job when there was somebody I could push, like, let me just touch my microphone barely. They go, hey, stop. I can't handle the change. It's too much. It's like, dude, it's sad. So,
but that's one of the things I like about hearing your work stories when we get together outside of this arena. And you've got a lot of leadership qualities that I wish that I had in myself, not for the point of being management or a VP or anything, but I think that if I was a better leader, then my engineers could be better engineers.
It sounds like you're doing a pretty good job.
I try.
And I think we bring different leadership skills to different leadership situations. I do not like stagnant organizations. I believe we should build organizations. It sounds like you're doing this, build an organization. People have an opportunity to learn something every day where they can do their best work, where they are engaged in what they're doing. And if they're stuck in, you know, how much work are your engineers getting done if they're in 6 hours of meetings a day? Not very much.
Right, right. And the downfall of your teaching your engineers to be better engineers and to learn new things is, right now I work with a team of 10. Five of them are senior engineers, myself included, and five of them are less than 5 years in the field completely. In fact, two of them are like right out of college. And in the last 3 years, we've gone through four right out of college engineers. They come on, they stay for 6 months, 8 months, and they learn a lot and they're just becoming productive and out the door. They're off to either another program within the company or off to another company. And it doesn't make me want to work with the engineers and make them better any less, but that is one of the pitfalls of helping to make your junior engineers into senior engineers.
And I'll tell a story from my last company after I asked this question, but is there less turnover given the current market situation where there aren't as many jobs for them to go to?
Well, the two newest members on our team are less than 6 months on the team. So, and that was, one was a replacement and one was a new, you know, a team expansion that we've been screaming for for several years.
I think a story I told on the podcast once, but in my last company, I was in some management or leadership meeting and they were, someone from HR was bragging about the fact that turnover was the lowest it had been in the last, you know, several years, completely failing to recognize the context that there were no jobs for them to get to.
Yeah. Out in the world, there's nothing to do.
So I do worry a lot there. There was something else I was going to ask about this, but maybe, I don't know. Do you like it? Do you like what you're doing?
If I didn't like it, I wouldn't have been doing it for the last 17, 18 years. And I get, you know, we've been talking about leadership and planning and all of that. But again, the days that just scream by, I'm like, oh man, it's time to go home already. Those are the days that I have some tough engineering problem I get to work on. And those, even though they're farther apart than they were in my beginning days here, those are the days that really make it for me. They make it worth it. When I get to see the younger engineers go, and they learn some new concept and things get better for them, that's another thing that makes it worth it. So it's kind of one of the reasons that I'm looking to retire and go into teaching from this job. I'd like that, being able to teach the young minds and give them new stuff.
Yeah, that's why I want to stay in software. I want to teach young minds and give them new stuff.
Yeah, well, I'm 30 plus years into software. Software, computers, hardware, networking, that was like my hobby when I was younger. And so I went, if this is my hobby, I can make it my job. And so I made it my job without any sort of formal training. I completed degrees after I already had the job to get the degrees that would allow me to continue to hold on to the job. And now I want to go teach the things that are my hobbies now, which are decidedly not computer and software related.
Yeah, that's super cool. Speaking of hobbies and stuff, on the last podcast, when we did last week, we were talking about Andreas, and I think Andreas suggested this is should index like the transcripts of all of the A/B testing episodes.
Yeah, so, yeah.
I was bored.
And oh, goodness.
A script to download all the MP3s from Anchor, where we're hosted, was pretty easy. They came down pretty quickly. So there's like, this is episode 221, I think, but there's like, I did some bonus episodes that counted in this. So there's like 240 some episodes I downloaded. And then used Whisper AI and just used the Python library for it. And I went through, because I had time, I went ahead and picked a more efficient model so I could get better transcripts. I used Whisper AI to transcribe every single podcast into just a raw text dump, as well as some formats that are used by closed captioning systems. So I did that. It took about 24 hours to run. It was kind of cool. I mean, kind of, it's a MacBook Air, but it's an M4. So I'm not sure if it
was. Well, still, you're talking about 200 plus hours that you processing. That's pretty good.
Yeah. So I said 24 hours to process. It took a day.
Well, of the podcast.
Oh yeah, of the podcast. The math. There's like 240 hours of podcast. Yeah, I went through all those. I have transcripts, and then I think I'm going to put them into Notebook LLM or something. I could, but what I did first was I wrote a little Python search engine. Just I globbed together all the text files, and
you're
I can
feeding
search
the beast, man. I'm going to feed them into an LLM.
Of course, I have to, but for now, I'm not. But I can do things like I can pick like Principle 5 or project management or Scrum, and I can find which episodes that term was mentioned in, and how many times in that episode it was mentioned.
Wow.
So I'm going to do one right now. Let me find my command prompt. Where's my is that my thing? No. I forgot what I called it. Okay.
Yeah,
pick a word. Pick a word.
Oh, good Lord.
Good Lord.
No, that's okay. Not the word, but you know, it goes right out of your head.
On the spot, pick a word. We're gonna do this live. This is great.
All right. AI.
Oh my god.
Yeah.
I'm worried.
Yeah, I'm worried for you, because my comment was I was scrolling through the old episodes just this morning, and I noticed that a lot of them have
you're gonna
AI
love
in
this
the title.
Episodes with at least one mention. 10.
I don't believe
total mentions across those episodes. 1,000.
That seems a little small, but okay.
It seems like it would be more than 10, right? But maybe it didn't come out as. I bet it didn't come out. Yeah, something's weird
there. They might not be talking. They might not be counting like when you say artificial intelligence or LLM maybe. Instead.
What if I say Gen AI? Just to make that even better, closer. That's a lot. Let me scroll up here. Holy crap. Gen AI, still 10 episodes, but 103 mentions. Anyway.
I didn't say testing, because that would have been sank the ship.
That shows up in the intro, because the intro gets transcribed as well. So, not going to do that. But I searched for whiskey. There's like 10 of those or 8 of those. And it's fun. I'm not sure what I'm going
to
do with it, but it's there.
Yeah. It'd be interesting to see the increase in frequency of stuff like hiking, because, you know, you've been a hiker for a long time,
right,
but
there's all kinds
you did
of
a lot
stuff.
More talking
and,
about it.
And probably I should just, because they're just text files, I should maybe think about uploading all those text files. We have a, I forget what it's called. I haven't been to GitHub in a while, but we have a GitHub repository for the podcast.
Yeah.
I just put them up there. And then, you know, at some point, it has all the episodes up through last week. At some point I could just, you know, do it with the rest of them. I got to think about it. There's something there. And there was on Slack, there was a great quote. It said, I'm going to find it real quick here. What was it? There's a German proverb that translates roughly into having is better than needing. So now you have the transcripts. When the time comes, you will know what to do with them. So I have them. I'll know what to do with them when I find them.
I find that to be the hoarder's mindset, man. I'm telling you.
I'll hoard digitally, but
I get that. I'm just as bad physically with certain things, but digitally, I have weaned myself off of it in that I don't have a large storage area network filer in the house anymore, but. Yeah, I used to hold on to stuff for way too long and never went back to it. Just it was the having, not the needing at that point.
Well, I think you can be selective about what you need and
well, and yeah. I am now, so it just which eliminates the need for having a multi terabyte filer in the house anymore.
Yeah, for sure. All right, man. I think it's probably a good enough place to wrap it up. Any other thoughts on anything else you want to talk about? Any shout outs, comments? I don't know what to ask you.
I don't think so. I mean, that would be of little interest to the two other people who listen to the podcast.
Hello, you two. Good to have you here. All right, then. Well, sorry, you going to say something?
No. Go right ahead.
Well, let me find my fancy buttons here, and let's call it a day. I've been Spy.
I've been Tim.
All right. We'll see you next time on the Spy Somebody Else podcast.